Super K.
Hello, you are listening to another episode of Super Gay. I'm Johnny Jungle Guts.
And I'm Professor Extra.
And this is the podcast where we talk about all things gay and comics and more.
But mostly comics.
Like any episode of Super Gay, we have to start off by talking about X-Men. That's right. What the kids want to hear. They want to hear about X-Men.
Yes, it's true. Well, so the latest queer X-Men news is that we may have an X-thruple on our hands by Jean and Logan and Scott, which is something that seems to be highly hinted at in latest issues of Powers of 10 and House of X by Jonathan Hickman, which is the whole new X-Men explosion right now. And this is fueled by an image at the big mutant party. Do you recognize this image, Johnny?
Oh, I couldn't miss it. It's been all over Twitter.
Yeah. So what is your interpretation of what we're looking at? Tell the listeners what you are viewing.
Well, Logan's in the middle. He's got his arm around Jean in her classic Marvel Girl outfit. And then he's got his arm around Psyche in a more modern Cyclops look. And then he's got a fist full of beer. He's got a six-pack in his hands. It's a funny sort of triptych of almost a timeline of X-Men because you have Marvel Girl's classic look, then Wolverine's sort of brown and orange 80s moment, and then this very modern interpretation of Cyclops.
Yeah.
And they're all very smiley with each other.
Yeah, yeah. And it's actually Cyclops and Logan who are making eye contact, as it were, and Jean just looks really happy with her hand on her hip, and she's wearing a miniskirt. So this fueled a lot of speculation in, as you mentioned, the Twitter sphere and other sites of X-Men contemplation. And one of the other issues that came out, the latest issue of Uncanny X-Men, showed that the new living quarters, which have a diagram included in the issue, the living quarters of the Summers family, which includes Scott and his whole family, Cyclops and all his kids and stuff from other dimensions, and Jean Grey. And in between their two bedrooms is a bedroom for Logan. So they have three bedrooms next to each other with an adjoining Wolverine room, and it's kind of like the picture here. So Wolverine is clearly in the middle of this relationship, of this throuple. He's the third, right?
And of course,
and they're treating him like it.
Well, we'll see where this goes. I feel like we're gonna get into a lot of heavy hints today on the show because of editorial at Marvel and DC not wanting to go all the way as these writers would like to do.
But don't you think the teasing is part of the whole fun of it at a certain point? And then it gets frustrating, right? But
yeah, it's like a whole dance. There's a choreography to this that we see sort of over and over again.
I agree. So let's talk about what we're going to talk about today. We are talking about the House of Extraño. In our interview with Steve Orlando, which I hope you guys have had a chance to listen to, when I asked him about his reinvention of the character Extraño, he mentioned that Luciano Vecchio, who is our last guest, had some criticism. So I asked Luciano about that, and he emailed me back. I don't know, should we read his email? I think we have permission.
We certainly can. We should make sure all our listeners know that this will be... This should have been read by someone with an Argentinian accent.
Oh, well,
But I'll give it a shot. So here's what Luciano said about Extraño. It was on New York Comic Con last year after we shared the panel. I sketched the Extraño redesign from my art book right there and asked him what his description was for the artist and that I'd like him to maintain some of his marica, sissy/queen, political identity. Like mask. Gay characters, including Midnighter, are okay, but for Extraño, in particular, with his over-the-top flamboyant past representation, the result felt like mask washing to me. Like if taking the femme campiness away is quote-unquote fixing him. Luciano joked that he would make House of Extraño with Extraño as mother for queer Latinx and POC superheroes, and I thought immediately of the drawing of Bunker as a Voguer.
Yeah, so in his book, Queer Gaze, that we talked about last episode, we did mention that he drew Bunker as a Voguer. Bunker, the gay Mexican metahuman member of the Teen Titans, who was introduced in 2011. So this episode focuses on DC's very first gay superhero from 1987, Extraño, a Latinx HIV-positive character introduced, in the Millennium book of, I think it was 1987, and then 1988, The New Guardians, which runs for 12 issues. His reintroduction in contemporary comics was through Steve Orlando's Midnighter and Apollo series. And today we're going to talk about him.
I will say this was my first introduction to Extraño. I had was not familiar with that character at all. And I'm sure if you had asked me who the first HIV positive DC character was, I probably would have said Speedy, the female Speedy from the 2000s, and I would have been wrong. So this was an update to my information.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. Well, let's go into it. I mean, according to DC Fandom Wiki, Extraño is quite possibly DC Comics' first openly gay superhero. So they, because the issue is he's not entirely openly gay, even though he's so heavily gay. So this is a thing that kind of is part of the reason why people don't know for sure if he's the first gay character, but he was portrayed as resembling, according to the even on the wiki of DC Fandom, nearly every stereotype of a gay man, initially wearing loose, colorful garments and playing the role of comic relief. His flamboyant characterization elicited various responses from readers, from amusement to hatred. Perhaps as a reaction to the comments of readers, Extraño was redesigned to wear more traditional masculine superhero costume. Now, so this seems to be a thing. It's happened to him more than once, but there's a reason for that. And anyway, he apparently this is the debate, because Marvel, he's definitely DC's first queer character that was like a superhero that they really wrote the gayness in, but Marvel was the first one to actually have the character say, "I'm gay," when North Star came out in the early 90s. So North Star still holds the distinction for first gay superhero in a sense, but we have this predecessor here in Extraño, who is now currently back in comics, in a very kind of subtle way, as a member of the Justice League Dark kind of comic book. He like is in there somewhere. You'll see him every so often. But he's back. So let's go back to where he started. So Johnny, I made you read these. What happens? How does Extraño get introduced?
Okay, so there's this whole sort of intergalactic hullabaloo where the Guardians, who are sort of the bosses of the Green Lanterns, and the Zamorons, the Zamorons, who are sort of in charge of the Star Sapphires, they sort of make a truce, and then also are having sex with each other to create some mystical energy that's going to sort of revitalize the universe in the new millennium, and they feel like Earth is sort of the site to start with that. And so they go to Earth and find a handful of people that they say are the chosen ones, though they have sort of built in a failsafe where some of them could die and it would still be okay.
Yeah.
It's a pretty wacky comic. I'm not sure I got all those facts right, because there's just so much going on here.
I mean, you got more of the plot than I did, but Steve Englehart wrote this and Joe Staton drew it. And it's pretty interesting. Through it, they are introducing these characters, the New Guardians, who are the chosen ones. And we don't know what they're chosen for, and we don't know why they were chosen. And they're very random people from all over the world. It is interesting that there's the white man in the group is actually a South African. This is 1987, 88. There's a South African politician who supports apartheid. who's depicted as a mega big, fat, bloated, racist guy in a suit with a Dutch name and all that. And so that's the villain, but he's also one of the chosen ones. And so the Guardians had chosen a villain. They also, who are some of the other characters that you remember? The Aboriginal child named Betty.
There was an Aboriginal child named from Betty, a Jamaican girl living in the UK,
mm-hmm.
Named cool. Celia.
I liked her.
A Chinese gal named Zhang, mm-hmm. a Japanese guy named Takeo, who was like a CEO type,
mm-hmm.
and Jason Woodrow, the Floronic Man, who was a character throughout DC Comics and is the creator of Poison Ivy, is probably best known as the person who kind of created Poison Ivy.
Oh, okay. So, wow. He's like Poison Ivy's dad, the Floronic
In a
man.
Way, yes.
Floronic. It's a pretty crazy name. He's really crazy looking. He looks like tree bark with a face.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Emaciated tree bark with a face. Yeah. I love the storyline that Alan Moore did for Swamp Thing where he fights the Floronic Man, and the Floronic Man wants to make all the animals go extinct, but then he realizes that if he makes all the humans and the animals go extinct, then the plants won't have anything to breathe. And so he's forced to admit that they need each other because he hates meat. He hates human
he hates
and,
meat
and animal bodies.
He hates all that. He's a plant guy. So this is written by Steve Englehart, who wrote for The Avengers. He wrote Captain America. I think he introduced the character Falcon, I'm pretty sure. Detective Comics, Doctor Strange. He wrote a really memorable run of Green Lantern in the 80s that I loved, and some Justice League of America. He's been around a long time, and he's a really interesting writer. He is is an interesting attempt here at representation of kind of diversity and a global kind of imaginary. There are a lot of stereotypes in it, in the way that not only the characterizations, but also the way that these characters are drawn by Joe Staton. But at the
and
same
colored.
Time, and colored. Yeah. Thank you. But I would say at the same time, it's kind of notable in its attempt to depict hero characters who aren't stereotypically beautiful in the kind of way that the Justice League characters are, who they are first kind of contrasted to.
Oh yeah, I mean, there's a couple different comics that immediately pop into my mind when I'm looking at this. The first is The Authority, and the other is Grant Morrison's The Invisibles, which isn't even quite a superhero comic, but these were two superhero teams who the writers had sort of tasked with the responsibility of consciousness raising, of a sort of awakening of the world through superheroics. It's funny looking at this because it doesn't have the cynicism of The Authority or sort of the occult far-reachingness of The Invisibles, but it does have a sort of misplaced sincerity that I kind of like.
There's something there. It's interesting. I mean, the artist is known for doing things like Dick Tracy and Guy Gardner, you know, and he won an Eisner in 1998, it looks like. He's been around, like, I don't know. It's an interesting situation because there's a kind of attempt here at specificity, and that kind of veers into weird stereotypes. And I would say, like, for example, the costume design of Extraño when we first see him is he's in a bar in Peru, right? And he says, ay, 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 Geraldo, at last your drinks are having their desired effect. A woman in armor and a bite-sized man. And then we have the Zamoran and the Guardian appear in the bar, and it's a gay bar. I mean, there's only guys right in the bar, and he's leaning up against the bar wearing an unbuttoned kind of flowery pink and fuchsia shirt, and it's with a big gold necklace, lots of chains, a big gold earring, slick back black hair with like one curl forward, a teeny tiny mustache that kind of curls up, tight green jeans, and sort of boots with like fringe on them that go up to the mid-calf. Have I missed anything?
No, I mean, he's just everything. He's like, it's like the Birdcage or something like that. It's just everything that gives straight people anxiety about gay people in one sort of image. Mm-hmm. Throughout the books, his skin color goes from, and it could have been the scans I was reading too.
Yeah.
Here it's a reasonable sort of pinkish, but other times it's sort of that full-on pink red that was also applied to Danny Moonstar in the New Mutants, you know, this when they're trying to depict someone with indigenous heritage, they just give them red skin, you know.
Yeah, it has a sort of there's a problem there. And they can't really decide what he is. I mean, I think he's like, the thing is he's a mix of, now here's the thing, and I think this is interesting, he's a kind of mix of stereotypes of Latin representation, the mustache, the earring, etc., but it's all made into like gay representation, you know.
Yes, and that's a thing that you, I think, when you're getting into sort of a white fantasia of otherness, mm-hmm. they have a tendency to butt up against each other because mm-hmm. I think for white America, Latin men, you know, from the perspective, they aren't afraid of being sexual beings, having their own sexuality. And that in alone has a sort of proximity to queerness for a white America where I think women are supposed to hold the sexual power and men are supposed to hold the financial power.
Yeah.
What I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, it makes me think a little bit about how the original Latin lover in cinema in the United States.
Of course. Of course.
You know, is Valentino. And then everybody thought he was, gay because he was kind of femme and he's a feminine man in the sense that he was to be looked at, he was to be desired, right? But this is a kind of different thing where I also think there's a kind of culture that they're trying to represent that might in fact exist. Like I feel like there is a way to be a Latinx queen with a lot of power and still have a kind of, you know, like intense aesthetic, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, and he has
and
all
use
of that.
That femininity as a way of empowering yourself, and on different spectrum of, you know, gender representation. So it's interesting. Like on the one hand, I see where the Orlando position was sort of, we have to fix this representation by you know, bringing it into a much more superheroic register in a way. And we'll get to that later. But I also understand why you might say that this is an interesting, in that it's attempting to represent a particular person who's not always there in comics, and that is the kind of Latin queen who could be just as easily a superhero as anybody else.
I mean, I don't really have any problem with it other than the skin tone choices, and then I guess you could argue about who's writing it. Do you know what I mean? You wonder about the thoughtfulness from Steve Englehart's perspective, but you know, this is a person that could in theory exist.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I guess it's like, it's kind of, you know, it is, it's interesting. Let's just talk about the specific moments and maybe we can figure this out. So, I mean, it's important that he appears in a bar first. So he's at a gay bar. They try to pick him up at the gay bar and he kind of reads them, right? A woman in armor and a bite-sized man. He's like, ooh, you're small and you're a crazy, like, masculine woman. So that actually makes a lot of sense in the gay bar anyway. And then they come in and they say, you know, what do they say to him? Do you want to read them? Read them in two different types of voices.
The Zamaron, by the way, I love this horrible Zamaron look that we get throughout this book. It's like, you know, it's sort of like military tutu. And then the Zamarons always have this sort of snide effect because they're borderline villains.
Mm-hmm.
So she's just like sort of annoyed in this awful outfit all the time.
Yeah.
But she says, we have chosen 10 people on Earth to advance the human race. And one of the 10 is you. The heroes and heroines of Earth join us in asking you to leave this life and enter the future.
Ooh, he got to leave this life. He has
to leave his life behind. Got to leave the bar behind.
Got to leave that life. All right. So he says, so then he says in response to them, and by the way, the bite-sized man is blue, has a very large forehead with a kind of receding space hair, I would describe it as. Would you? I think that's space hair. And then
White space hair, sure.
White space hair. And then he has a red kind of long shirt that goes all the way to the ground that has butterfly collar, and then it has the Green Lantern logo on the front. So nobody is dressed in a way that isn't kind of crazy. And even the extras in this scene, I think they're referring to like Peruvian kind of folk garb or something, but it also looks a little bit like lederhosen, but it also looks a little bit like they're at a gay bar, like a leather bar.
Yeah. I think, honestly, to his credit, I think Steve Englehart did a lot of reading for this book. I think he did try to do some real research.
Well, what do you base that on? The fact that he calls this guy Pepetito?
I mean, there's things that are so profoundly wrong, but then there are like little things that just seem so specific that it feels like he must have read something somewhere, you know, statistics that he throws out from time to time historical facts.
I think he based, this is my fantasy, I think he based this character on someone he knows. So anyway, the character says, "Please, the only fruits anybody picks down here are bananas. And for that, you go to Ecuador." And then his like buddies say,
"But Gregorio, they faded in.
Pepetito, after all the days and nights I've spent in this stinking cantina, everybody fades in. No offense, Geraldo, my very own. Just give me another gin."
But Gregorio.
Yeah. So that's his first like appearance of seeing these space people. And he's like, "Fuck you guys. I don't care. You're just like everybody else here." And then he tries to commit suicide in the next issue.
He's saved by the Flash. He tries to jump off a pier into the ocean. He thinks he's drunk enough that he'll just drown. Mm-hmm. And then the Flash runs in and grabs him. So running so fast, he can walk on water. Mm-hmm. And you can see that Extraño is still wrestling with his own internalized homophobia. Mm-hmm. And feels like he just lives in a world where no one loves him, where he is incapable of being loved.
Yeah, I mean, he's getting taunted on the street by sailors. I guess he's on the boardwalk at this point. He's being taunted by sailors. Then he says to himself in thoughts, "They despise me." But then, you know, about issue 5 of this thing, and this is a crazy conflagration. So he's just one of 5 people that we're tracking as some of these chosen people get murdered by the KGB, and other ones are having all kinds of issues of their own. Political problems with Chinese communism. There's a kind of conversation around Japanese economic imperialism. They all end up kind of flying off with Superman or something to be with the Guardians and do a retreat, basically like a yoga retreat or something, or like a consciousness raising retreat in outer space. And he decides to go with them because, of course, and you know, his personality just sort of kind of develops. I mean, there's this weird exchange between him and Betty, the girl from Australia, and they're going to have a really weird relationship because eventually she turns into a sort of spirit creature that just lives in his brain.
That's right.
But at this point, what does she say to him?
She says, "I am less amazed by the Emerald Stone's powers than I am by the clothing you iTime people wear."
He responds, "What I wear amazes most of them too, honey."
Honey.
And then he says, you know, later when they are all asking, "Are you guys going to all transform your bodies into super bodies?" Well, there's this. Okay, I just want to point this one thing out. During the retreat, they're all dancing to like music that's coming from outer space or something. And he thinks to himself in Spanish, we know, because there's these little brackets on the side while he's dancing, "I can use the gentle side of me instead of having someone else do it."
What does that mean to you?
Well, I don't know. What does that mean to you? I mean, I can use the gentle side of me instead of having someone else do it. That's what he thinks.
I can't even. Is he talking about having gay sex or something? I don't know what's going on here.
Yeah. Anyway, all right. So he thinks that while he's dancing in space, and then he decides, "Well, dears, I never thought I'd do anything to advance evolution, but I tried to end my own evolution, and that wasn't the high point of my day. So why not?" So he goes on, you know, he goes on to get transformed into this super version of himself. And each of them gets this. They all have different names and different powers that appear. And so how would you describe Extraño's transformation?
Well, you know, he suddenly has almost these horns. His over-the-top Little Richard / Prince haircut becomes even more elaborate with sort of horns and hair shooting out the sides. His face is sort of elongated in a manner that really registers as villainous to me. In the way that they used to draw some of the classic DC villains like the Joker. Mm-hmm. And then he has pirate boots, green pants, and then a sort of cape / jacket, a cloak that that sort of billows around his body to give him a sort of almost like wedding cake type silhouette.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's got an enormous robe on and a lot of jewelry. And he's and his face really is remarkable to me because it's very long in comparison to the way that usually superhero faces are drawn. And he looks just wild. Apparently, he's magical. When he learns that his name is going to be now Extraño, he says the Spanish for strange.
Very clearly trying to say this is sort of like the gay Doctor Strange here.
Okay, that's
or yeah. Or the Peruvian Doctor Strange, however you want to take it.
I think it's both.
This is part of it's both. And this is part of why this book reminds me of The Authority, because in The Authority you have gay Batman and gay Superman.
Sure. Well, yeah. I mean, okay. Definitely, that's happening here. I think it's also like literally, he says, I am strange, wondrous strange. And the use of Spanish when we all speak English here makes it even clearer. So it's all that, right? Everything you just said. Dreaming on the universal unity, I saw myself unraveling and filling out the darkness. And then all this color shoots everywhere. And he just seems like a lot of fun. But he also seems a little bit crazy and a little embarrassing. Right? I guess that's how I feel about him.
I mean, I'm just sort of along for the ride. I really kind of can't take a lot of issue with him other than as the book goes on, the writer seems more interested in developing even characters that aren't part of this team, like Kilowog, for example, than developing the actual team members.
Well, Kilowog was kind of his character from Green Lantern. I think he felt like he wanted... Yeah, that happens. But so the plot of New Guardians is kind of a mess. So what happens is Millennium ends, and that one was, I mean... You know, what could you even really say about what happened there? Millennium ends with the New Guardians becoming the New Guardians, and then there's a new comic book all of a sudden in 1988 called New Guardians, and it starts at issue number one, and it's these characters, and it's the same artistic team. And, you know, very early on, it kind of goes awry. I would say it goes awry very early on. But... the first issue, that I noticed that our friend Extraño is doing a lot of emotional labor, and this is going to be a theme throughout all of these comic books, that these characters who are this kind of the Latinx queer character in the House of Extraño does a lot of emotional labor. So in the first moment, he kind of explains... And this is, by the way, he's never really said I'm gay, right? But it's about context, would you say? Context and signifiers.
It's all about context, but I just want to say that what's very obviously going on here is editorial would not allow Steve Englehart to announce that this character was gay.
So he does everything he can to say it without saying those words.
It couldn't be more apparent. It's beyond subtext for me. It's literally just... not being able to say those words and being able to say everything else.
So let's talk about this scene that happens very early on when they're talking about what is their purpose in life. Do you want to read Gloss, a.k.a. Shang?
Yes. Okay, let's so she says, this. No, Lila, we can't walk around like gifts from the gods, even though we are.
I don't see us as being all that elite, Shang. In fact, I don't know how I see us.
And then we have Celia pipe in and say, what do you mean, Gregorio?
Well, Celia, we're evolutionarily advanced by the guardians of the universe with powers to protect us from danger. But have you thought what we're here to do? Basically, my darling ones, we're here to pass along our new DNA, or to put it on more practical level, to have kitties. Or you are. I'm certainly not. I don't know what I'm here for, but you're here to breed. And let's not forget, Floro is a plant. And then you see Floro.
And so the thesis here is actually that the only person who could maybe do the male side of the breeding is Takeo, who's kind of become a computer man. So who knows if he can even do it?
I don't think he can. Later, he says he's no longer interested. And if he is a half computer like that, he doesn't have. They haven't. I mean, maybe he could just put one on, right? Anyway, so. Then we see Harbinger, who we haven't mentioned, but you remember her from Crisis on Infinite Earths, right?
Of course.
I love that character.
The, linchpin of that series. And obviously, you know, that series was about reinventing the DC universe and celebrating it. And so she's brought over here because, once again, this book is about consciousness raising and looking towards the future.
Right. Okay. Consciousness raising and looking towards the future. So with that in mind, so in this book, she's depicted kind of as this space woman who's a bit innocent of human experience and has never really lived on Earth. She was actually somebody who worked alongside the Monitor, right? And that character Pariah, and like, what was the other one? Anyway, whatever. These crazy kind of cosmic concept characters. And her reward for the success of Crisis on Infinite Earths is now being on this crazy team with these people, where she's now one of the chosen ones of the Guardians. And so she's having trouble adjusting to her emotions, and she talks to our friend Extraño, and he says, "Listen, honey, your old auntie's here to tell you sex can be highly overrated. It took me years to figure out what I wanted, so take your time." Then say what she says, because it's funny.
"Oh, thank you. I needed to talk to some... Oh, is it all right if I hug you?
Honey, this is friendship, not sex. You do have a lot to learn, don't you?" Okay, so that's kind of like the nicest thing that will ever happen in this comic book, because the next character that's introduced is the Hemogoblin from South Africa.
Hemogoblin.
Okay,
he's so... he's a supervillain dying of AIDS.
Yeah. How is he depicted?
He's depicted as a little zombie guy, and he fights all the guys, all the guardians, and he transmits the HIV virus to Cilia and to Extraño and to Harbinger. But somehow Cilia's condition very quickly progresses to full-blown AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know how that's going on. No. And she ends up sacrificing her life to save the rest of the team in a big battle, and it's a whole moment, but then she's gone. It sort of reminded me a little bit of Thunderbird from X-Men, though of course he didn't have HIV.
I mean, she lasts a bit longer, about 8 issues or something like that, and it is interesting how they introduce it. It's a mess, though. I mean, the idea of this character, let's just backtrack. I mean, you're totally right. That's Celia's story, and Celia is a character who looks really cool. She's kind of
really
a
cool
bald black woman with purple and gold kind of space Africa costume, and then green, multiple
flames.
Green flame streaks on her head, which is bald
almost
otherwise.
Like in the pattern of cornrows shooting out of the back of her head.
Yeah, she's
they go completely balls to the wall with almost all of the costume choices here. Mm-hmm. And I really kind of appreciate that.
Yeah.
But,
Shang, who becomes this character Gloss, her costume is barely, it's amazing. There's just like so little of it. It's like sleeves.
And no shoes, because she has to be in touch with the earth to touch the dragon lines. I will say that the interesting thing about Gloss is she goes from being this sort of very staid Chinese girl to this very sort of sexy lady. And what I noticed was that her hair actually lightens in color as she becomes more erotically charged. I thought that was a funny choice.
It reddens.
Yeah.
I think that you are avoiding talking about the Hemogoblin. So, okay, one more thing about the Hemogoblin. What is he dressed like? He's wearing this kind of fetish outfit, right? He's like this bald... white, so white he's pale white, yellow, with pointy fingernails, and this brown leather like leotard with sleeves that's leather, with like a harness, like a gold harness.
I mean, yeah, this doesn't fully, the colors don't, it doesn't fully read to fetish to me more than almost
colored,
any other superhero supervillain costume.
On this guy? I don't know.
I just don't. I mean, I see what you're saying now, but like, if I'm looking at it that way, then I have to look at so many other superhero costumes that way, and I kind of already do.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
well,
so
anyway,
it's just going along with.
But
he
also, by the
too.
Way, has no shoes on, and he runs through the streets, slashing people and apparently spreading HIV, which the Guardians find out at the end of the episode in this sort of moment where they say, you know, he had AIDS, and then the And then the narration says,
tough time, 1988. Continued next month.
Yeah. He has AIDS, tough time, 1988, continued next month. I think that's an interesting representation of the time. You know, clearly that's the issue that they're trying to deal with in this comic book. And so three of the characters are positive, and we have to kind of watch that play out over the 12 episodes that this thing, or whatever it is, you know, it's like a year of issues that come out. But the second villain they fight is Snowflame. How did you feel about Snowflame?
I mean, it's just funny here. It's almost like the sort of from the Captain Planet school of supervillainy, where you just have the supervillains physically embody the ills of the world. He is a cocaine-powered superhero who's dressed in a sort of Santa costume without sleeves, and he is just losing his mind, fighting him on cocaine. I mean, the first thing that's interesting,
his like speech, his first speech when he says, yeah, like, I am Snowflame. That. You do it.
I am Snowflame. Every cell of my being burns with white hot ecstasy. Cocaine is my god, and I am the human instrument of its will.
So, you know, I mean, I think they're on cocaine. I can't say that because I don't know for sure, but allegedly they might be on cocaine when they're writing this comic book. I don't know.
Oh, okay. All right.
I don't know. It just feels like somebody was on cocaine in 1988 at DC Comics.
Who wasn't on cocaine in 1988?
That's
come on.
I'm kind of putting out there. But yeah, I mean, when they say give up, he's like, give up. Give up the ultimate exhilaration, the divine rapture, the euphoria of electricity now courses through every molecule of my body. Give up. I would sooner choke on the soil from your boots. Okay. So that's a good advertisement for cocaine. And then he turns into a superpowered villain that fights them for an episode. So that.
Well, then he snorts a mountain of cocaine. Yeah.
He literally snorts cocaine while he's saying that. And then he's like starts glowing with like
just white, handfuls.
White flames come out of him.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
By issue three, yeah, we're at the AIDS clinic and Jet has AIDS and they're in a support group for HIV. And he has some interesting thoughts during this. I mean, he's kind of put into a funny position. Because we start to get Extraño's narration as he's looking at Harbinger and Jet, aka Cilia, who both were scratched by the monster. But actually, one thing that should be pointed out is the white woman got the same wound as her black counterpart. They both seem to have the same powers, these two women.
Yes.
And they are bonded in this weird way. So she basically contracted the virus by getting scratched, by a friend of hers getting scratched. So that's weird. And then he got scratched, Extraño got scratched by the hemoglobin separately. And he's thinking while he's looking at them in this kind of notable, I thought a kind of beautiful page in issue number three when they're in the clinic or about to get their diagnoses. And he's thinking virus envelope, arc, T4 cells, immune suppressants, words. Words the members of my own particular high-risk group had come to learn some time ago. Words that up until today held little meaning for the other new guardians. Words that would soon be spelling the difference between life and death for two muchachas who were friends.
Yeah, there's a weird thing for me going on here between Harbinger and Jet where it almost seems like they're a couple or something, you know?
Mm-hmm. But also it seems like it's interesting. If you say that, that means that the hemoglobin gave HIV to the three queer-coded characters, one of whom is totally explicit and the other two are more subtextual.
Yeah, I think that that's totally fair. I mean, what's interesting about the hemoglobin is he's sort of sent by this South African racist guy mm-hmm. to deal with the heroes. So he's kind of like, he is representational of the AIDS virus, but he's also sort of representational of everyone's fears about HIV right. and AIDS.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he's the worst. So then, you know, we have these moments where throughout this kind of narrative, there is a consideration that Extraño has about his status that seems to recur. And it seems to also be a thing that's happening in the letters column of this comic book. I don't know if you had a chance to look at any of the letters. We don't have to read them.
I glanced over a few of them, but I didn't catch any that were specifically talking about Extraño. Did you? You caught some.
Yeah, there's quite a few. In fact, the whole question of representation of HIV, of the possibility of contracting the virus by being scratched by a demon, all these things were kind of addressed in the letters column.
If you're interested in that, we're going to be posting our summary of the episode online with some of the best panels, and that will include some of the stuff from the letters column. Also, in an issue of this book, they advertised for a comic book released by another publisher called Strip AIDS USA, and it's cartoons about AIDS by concerned cartoonists. And I was surprised by some of these names. The proceeds were going to a AIDS nonprofit, but I was surprised by some of the names that were here, some big names. It was heavily edited by Bill Sienkiewicz, which I thought was notable.
Mm-hmm.
And also on the list of artists involved are Sergio Aragonés, mm-hmm. Will Eisner,
yeah.
Gilbert Jaime, Mario Hernandez, mm-hmm. Frank Miller, Mobius,
yeah.
Harvey Bekar. It's quite a range.
We got to get our hands on this. So Strip AIDS
USA. We really
USA,
do. This is a whole episode
collection.
In itself.
Yeah, 140-page collection from 1988. So that
I'm kind of amazing. Worried about what Frank Miller has to say, but
I mean, always worried about Frank Miller. But this seems to be, I guess, the mission of the book in a way is to talk about this because we have all these representations of people protesting outside the clinics and keep our county AIDS free, no AIDS clinic here. And then the superheroes have to go into it to get, to go to their support group, to get their meds. So that all happens. And Harbinger freaks out, which isn't totally surprising to me. But at the same time, she is from outer space. So maybe she could handle this a little bit better. But she's really upset about the stigma of AIDS. And she can't endure it, she says. And she flies out of the clinic while other people are talking in the share circle.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot. There's a lot going on. And eventually, sadly, as I said before, Jet passes away. And that causes these sort of moment of reflection with all the Guardians. And
but
Betty
she passes
shows up.
Away. Who's Betty? Oh, yeah, Betty. Okay, so wait, we have to go back. So wait. She passes away but she has AIDS. They keep saying it. She's in bed a lot, Jet, this character. But then she will, at the end, she decides to fly up into space and destroy this enemy fleet of invading aliens. Is that what happens?
Sure.
And they, so then she gets a heroic death, but then she also gets the deathbed with the doctors around her and space aliens trying to cure her of AIDS, which is crazy. But that's actually literally happening. Plus, she's shown next to a bunch of meds. And then she just goes out and flies into space and then explodes in green fire and kills all these aliens. Then they're having a funeral for her and some of the Guardians can't deal with it. But Extraño ends up in this situation where he goes back to Peru and to his old neighborhood, right? And
that's right.
And so this is where he gets his kind of mask makeover. But it's also this kind of interesting moment where he goes to a graveyard that he says, Ramon, Pedro, Thomas, so many of you, amigos, I have lost so many of you to this vile scourge. And then a lightning bolt strikes and he finds a crystal skull in the ground, and that gives him new powers and a new outfit. And on the cover, he's holding the crystal skull like he's Hamlet.
That's true. Oh, yeah.
It's hot.
And I don't know what the whole story is with that whole mythology around crystal skulls, but there's it's like a whole thing.
It's a whole thing. So then he flies back to the rest of the Guardians and, he says, and Floronic Man says, that is quite a new look. I don't know. It's an update. He's wearing a lot less. He's made the giant. So the crystal skull zaps him and he's just a little bit more buff. His face is a little sharper in the edges. His hair is more flowing behind him than above him. And his chest is out because he's wearing a vest that is made of his old big jacket cloak. He's got some gold armbands. He's got more of a sash, a gold sash, but he has like tight green pants and blue boots, just like he's always had. That's always been his thing, you know? And he's got this crystal skull, and he just seems a little more, actually, I don't know, a little more traditionally superheroic, wouldn't you say?
I think he is more pulling off a sort of double read you could make, where you could either just see him as mystical or you could still read him as very queer. But he's not as over the top as he was in his first look, which I honestly preferred. I think a lot about the drag queen Kimchi talks a lot about silhouettes in fashion, and silhouettes in the Western world are very often designed to highlight different parts of the body. And then in Korea, you know, they have outfits that are just sort of just designed to just create a dramatic silhouette, period. And that was kind of one of the things that made his first look a rarity, is that it was really just about the clothes. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. He gets to be now drawn a little differently. And this was something that was brought up in the letters column. There was back and forth about his representation. And some people saying, you know, we like him, but we don't like his outfit. He's crazy. But and he looks like a villain. I think that was the thing a lot of people thought, which is, you know, purple, green and all that stuff. But
and also just the shape of his face. I mean, I think this artist, I think there's a subconscious thing going on here where, you know, historically, some villains in comics are even easier to queer than the heroes.
Right.
So that's something that's in the ether, I think, too.
Yeah, at the same time, I like that he has like a particular face with a certain kind of nose and a certain kind of chin. He and actually, I even like the fact that he sort of looks like a villain, because it makes him more interesting when you're thinking about how sympathetic he is. He doesn't get cured of HIV, but Harbinger does, because Jet dies. So that's weird. To me, I don't know how you feel about that storyline.
It doesn't make a lick of sense, because you would think if Jet were to die, Harbinger would also die. And also this idea that Harbinger contracted HIV because Jet did, but then Jet has full-blown AIDS and then Harbinger doesn't. It just, the sort of, even the comic book logic of it just doesn't really add up at all.
No, it doesn't. But the representational logic kind of does. Like, they killed off a black woman character.
Sadly, yes.
You know, like there's a horrible aspect to that, but also this weird attempt that they're continually grappling with, which is some kind of representation of the real, this tough time 1988 thing. It's really impossible to do in comics in a way that doesn't feel fucked up, but it's definitely interesting, you know, as a kind of document of the feelings and that moment. You know what I'm saying?
I mean, on the one hand, you know, there's the conversation about black women in healthcare, how they're not believed, how they don't get the same treatment as other people. And then there's just this other thing of, it's like, oh, let's get rid of the black character to elevate all these other characters. And it's funny, because when they start off Millennium, you know, you have the Aboriginal character, you have Jet, and you know, we can go back and forth about the sort of dialects they're given. They seem you know, I'm not super familiar with Jamaican or Aboriginal culture, but I don't know if it's accurate, but anyway,
it's not accurate because you read it and it seems it's not accurate of anything, but they
it's not accurate of anything, but they start off at least with these two black female characters in the book, and then they very quickly turn one into literally a talking head who's just there to give advice, and the other one dies to sort of elevate all these other characters' storylines.
Yeah, pretty much. They're all kind of amazed that Extraño is not super mad at Harbinger for running around screaming, "I'm cured. Have you heard the glorious news?" All this kind of stuff, which is so rude, right? Because they're at the okay, I'm sorry. Let me back up. They're at the doctor's office. The entire superhero team is at the doctor's office so that Extraño and Harbinger can have their tests for their doctors. So basically at the clinic, and they get the news that she's cured because the one lady's dead and he's not. And he kind of takes it well. He thinks about it for a while. He feels kind of dramatic. But in the end, basically, he just uses this to spur him in his decision that they need to lead the team into a final fight with the South African guy who sent the Hemogoblin to do this to them in the first place. And that's kind of where we end up, you know. They defeat the terrible character of the South African demon guy who turns into like a pig monster. It's interesting because I think that political cartooning is kind of part of what ends up happening with this book, because it's so much about things like, you know, 1988 tough time, guys, you know?
And it's so literal, too. Yeah. It's visually literal, you know? The cocaine supervillain looks like cocaine, you know?
Right. Yeah, it's a kind of literal allegory, and it's definitely dehumanizing and weird, but it's wrestling with something. And
he's trying his level best, Steve Englehart. Yeah. He's trying to get into these issues and get people talking about these issues.
I kind of want to look at 1988 again as a whole year to sort of see what's going on, because I noticed that there was also an advertisement for this Latinx superhero called El Diablo that was in this scan that we found. His ad is a full page, splash page ad in the issue. It says, this is the text: to the oppressed, a symbol of hope. To the oppressors, an object of fear, El Diablo. So he's just like, he's, you know, that's what's going on in 1988.
I mean, I feel like if I could only write one page about Steve Englehart's politics, I would probably think they were all pretty good. You know, he doesn't support apartheid in Africa. He's concerned about the AIDS virus, which is something that a lot of people at that time weren't even comfortable talking about.
Nope.
And he's, you know, gay friendly and all these types of things, but he just doesn't have the power in his body to execute all of this in a really thoughtful way.
Yeah. I mean, there are so many different circumstances, you know, when you think about this as a major comic book company putting this out in 1988 before they could even say the word gay. I don't know. I think there were a lot of editorial things that probably had an impact on it. I think the artist had certain strengths and limitations that were kind of in the same exact place. And so that was kind of hard with the book. But it's really interesting to look at as a kind of moment where people are trying to reckon with all these questions, and they keep talking about it in terms of 1988. So nowadays, he's still around. As I mentioned, he is in the Justice League Dark right now, popping around. He's been possessed by an evil shawl or something, I think, at one point, and stuff like that was happening with him. But he's more of a guy who just sort of stands around with a bunch of other magic people. But he is back, and that's thanks to Steve Orlando, who brought him in Midnighter and Apollo, as you will recall.
Yes, that's right.
And how would you describe how he looks now? He's drawn by Fernando Blanco.
Well, now he looks almost exactly like Doctor Strange because he has the white sideburns, and but he's very mildly dressed. I would definitely still probably think he was gay if I saw him on the street, because he does have a very thin purple scarf draped around his neck, and then he's got a green shirt on.
Yeah, and he's wearing a brown suit with the pants kind of tucked into these like ankle-high black boots. He's very tasteful. He has, I think, a little bit of jewelry somewhere to kind of like gussy it up, maybe like a necklace or something underneath it. I don't know. Maybe not even that.
I am not catching that. He's got luscious lips, I'll say that.
He's hot, though. He's like a daddy. He has a beard. And his skin tone, I think they got like the new computer coloring and all that. I think they got a lot nicer. He looks pretty handsome.
Oh, yeah.
And he lives in a really nice place in Peru, a magic place. Mm-hmm. He helps Midnighter find his dead boyfriend Apollo in hell. He helps him get there with a magic black candle. That's kind of a sexy scene where he hands him the candle. And then we learn at the end that he's married to a kind of werewolf guy, and that they have a daughter that they adopted who has angel wings. So that's currently where he's at.
We're just going for it. I mean, this whole journey that I'm on with this character is just quintessential DC for me, because they're just throwing us so much insanity all the time, just panel after panel, just these little facts are just so over the top.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a beautiful story. Do you think, so he's now a married dad. Okay, he went from being this kind of lonely, suicidal, in a bar alone guy to now being a magician who lives in Peru, seems to be fine. They don't talk about his HIV, but presumably he's fine because, you know, here he is doing magic. And he's got an adopted daughter with Hugh. And who is Hugh? Do you know Hugh? Do you remember Hugh? Have you seen Hugh before? Because I have.
I have seen him. I've certainly seen him before. And he is, what they're alluding to, I think, is the character Tasmanian Devil, who's a gay Australian superhero from the 80s super team, the Global Guardians. No relation to the New Guardians. But he was also a gay character.
Yeah. He was gay in the 80s.
Wolf he's like part man, part Tasmanian devil. He looks like almost like he kind of looks like a Wolfsbane.
He's got a real doggy face. He has a dog face.
Dog, yeah.
He's a furry, basically. He's brown.
Oh yeah.
And he has like a white T on his chest. That's his mark that makes you know he's a Tasmanian devil.
Tasmanian devil.
He has been gay since the 80s. I think in the 90s he was killed. I found a comic book where he's brought back to life, and he can also turn into a blonde, kind of twinky Australian guy.
Sure.
He says a lot of funny words. I recently read a whole run of Infinity Incorporated to do research for our upcoming episode where we're going to talk about Obsidian. And he was in that. And he's a lot of the Australian kind of shrimp on the Barbie stuff that we remember from the 80s, he says it.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. But he, you know, he says being gay in the 80s, he's talking to a friend of his, and he says, you know, things aren't as hateful for gays in some places. The Justice League are great. He becomes a member of the Justice League. I guess being a hero means setting yourself above prejudices. So he's a dog-faced man who says that, which is cool. And now he's living with, you know, and then at the end of the Midnight in Apollo series, it's like this cute party is happening at his house, at Extraño's house with Hugh. And Hugh's sitting there with them, you know, and he looks cute. He's wearing like a tank top. And Midnight in Apollo there and some friends, and they're just chilling.
They're chilling.
That's sort of, you know, I like to think of him ending up there after all that shit he had to go through in 1988.
Yeah.
Fucking bad year for Extraño.
Now he gets to have high tea with all the other gay superheroes.
Exactly. Yeah, and in fact, he does appear in Steve Orlando's Justice League of America run. I think Vixen goes to see him to get some advice.
Oh, okay.
And they have a like cafe meeting.
This has been another episode of Super Gay. Check out our sponsor, BearPad, and shop BearPad at BearPad.com. Probably already listening to the Linoleum Knife if you're listening to us. But if you're not, check out their Patreon, Linoleum Knife, Podcast of the Cinema. They're two married men who are also both film critics. And thanks to all of our sponsors, especially Anna Jones, who's giving a whopping $25 a month. Can't believe it.
Thanks.
So thank you, Anna.
Thank you.
All right, and have a super gay month.
Super gay!